So I'll give you a little introduction to the class, which I guess we did already last week during the registration, but just another a little bit of a better sense of what we're going to be doing here. Okay. Shiloh Tshuvot, Shiloh Tshuvot, is really a fascinating part of Jewish Torah literature. Okay, it's not Tanakh, it's not Gemara, it's not Rishonim, it's not Shulchan Aruch, it's not even Achronik, it's not even like the Mishnah Berurah, the Magen Avraham. Shiloh Tshuvot is what I mentioned last week, but essentially the idea that halacha is live, halacha is real, halacha is day-to-day, realistic. So therefore, it's not just about opening up like a Mishnah Berurah or opening up a Shulchan Aruch and saying, oh, that's nice, that's a nice halacha about, you know, Eruv. I don't have a faith state of what Eruv is. You know, Eruv, I have an Eruv, and my rabbi checks it, and I couldn't care less, okay? Shilas and Shuvas is basically the process by where people have real questions about real life in real society, and they say, I need to know the answer, I want to know what the Torah says. So they go to the Rav, they go to the Posek, they go to the Gadol, and they ask him. And some questions are pretty simple. Okay, yes, no, usher, mutter, yeah, daven again, don't daven again. You can turn on the light or not turn on the light, or whatever the case might be. And some questions are a little more complicated. Okay, some questions can really affect an entire society of people, or really people around the world. And these kinds of questions really need to be posed to the Gedolim, to the big Talmidei Chachamim that are the, you know, the great rabbis of each generation. And many of these rabbis throughout the generations have written svarim of Shilas and Tshuvas, of responsive literature, to basically explain their answers to people that ask. Now, what's really fascinating about it is that when you look at some of these Shilas and Tshuvas, you can actually get not just a bit of halacha, you can also get some history to understand a little better, well, what were they doing at that time? Okay, what did Jews live like in, let's say, the 18th century, or even in the 16th century, whatever it is? And sometimes these works will be like used by even non-Jewish historians when they're trying to figure out, well, what did Europeans, you know, what did they do in France in the 1300s? Like, how did they live and what did they do? So, you know, we have some documents, we don't have so much, but the rabbinic literature has been amazingly preserved very, very well throughout the generations because it's very important to us. So it's fascinating you can derive certain elements of history, Jewish history and even non-Jewish history, from elements of the Shilas and Tshuvas. So what we're going to try to do a little bit of both. Okay, we're going to give a little bit of history, historical background to the time period that we're doing. And again, most of the Tshuvas will be from the last 200 years that we're going to do, as well as some very interesting halacha. Okay, and a lot of the halacha will be very controversial. Essentially, what we're going to do is every week, we're going to take one big author of Shilas and Tshuvas, discuss a little bit about his background, the time he lived, and one major Tshuva that he wrote that was considered to be a very famous Tshuva, and discuss how that was, you know, part of maybe a bigger controversy at the time, maybe even today, and how that tshuva has had repercussions and implications, you know, all the way to today. Okay, so again, just to give you a heads up for the next couple weeks, I had a syllabus, I didn't print it out. If you want to see the syllabus, I'm happy to print it out for you. Just let me know afterwards, I can print it out. But I think next week we're going to do Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, maybe on electricity on Shabbos, which is a very fascinating thing, or salivation we're going to talk about, probably about women's tefillah groups, which is a very fascinating discussion that Rav Soloveitchik had, which is not exactly a tshuva, but we'll see, that was his style, it was not tshuvas, so we'll discuss that a little bit. On the Sridei Eish we're going to talk about, I mentioned, he wrote a big tshuva about Kolisha for the very first youth group in Europe. If you're familiar with it, you've heard of it? Okay, so basically do the tshuva inside. If you all tell me you've seen the tshuva before, then we won't do that, I'll choose something else from the Sridei Eish. Again, a fascinating figure between like the modern world and the Haredi world. He was, again, a very fascinating person. Talk about Rav Avadia Yosef, a few others. Again, it'll be basically your major poskim, and then each one will be a tshuva about something interesting that they spoke about. Okay, any questions on just the structure of the class? No? Okay, ready to have a sheet? Yeah, ready to rock? Okay, so today we are going to do Rav Moshe Feinstein. This is one that I knew that you all would have heard of, I think, right? If you haven't heard, you don't have to embarrass yourself and tell me, but I think most people have heard of Rav Moshe Feinstein, okay? The reason for that, I guess, why have you heard of Rav Moshe Feinstein? Okay, excellent. Again, remember your first name? I know. Atar, right? Okay, he lived in America and he lived recently. Okay, very good. Not everybody here is from America, though. Some people are from England. Right. Yeah. Have you guys heard of Moshe Feinstein, the English crew here?
Is he the one who wears a lot of tzitzis?
The what? A lot of tzitzis? No, it's not him. You're thinking of Rav Scheinberg.
Yeah. Okay.
He was here in Israel. Okay, Moshe lived in America. Rav Scheinberg lived here in Israel and he wore like 30 pairs of tzitzis or whatever. Okay, so for all the English people out there, Moshe Feinstein was a very, very great Talmud Chacham. He was one of the Gedolei Hador in America, and now he's very popular here in Israel as well, meaning everybody in Israel also knows about his tshuvas. He was in the last century. If you look at I put here a little section on the front. Yes, he's not alive. Look here, fast stats, that's what I titled this section here. He was born in 1895 in Russia. He died in 1986 in New York. Okay, and I think it was Tanis Esther, a very, very big funeral for Moshe. He lived mostly in Manhattan. Nobody hears from Manhattan, right? Okay, anybody know where he lived?
Lower East Side.
Okay, he was on the Lower East Side. Okay? He was, his official position was the Rosh Yeshiva of Mesivta Tiferes Yerushalayim, MTJ. Anybody ever heard of that?
Yeah.
It's a pretty famous yeshiva. It's not as big today as it used to be back then. He was the Rosh Yeshiva. What's fascinating, by the way, is that we'll discuss with Soloveitchik later, but Rav Moshe Feinstein and Soloveitchik were two of the great Gedolei HaDor in America over the past century or so. So which one of those two would you think was more the one who gave halacha, psak halacha, and which one of those two would be the one that was more into like Gemara and like learning, like Lumdus? What would you suggest? Those of you who know a little bit about either one.
I think Rav Moshe was more halacha.
Mm-hmm. And Rav Soloveitchik was
more Lumdus.
Yeah, Rav Soloveitchik was very much known for his analytical brisker shiurim that he gave in YU. Okay, we'll talk about the Rav again in a different week. What's fascinating about it is that Rav Moshe was called the Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Soloveitchik was called the Rav. Now, when you think about those terms, what does that mean to you? What does Rosh Yeshiva usually think of? What does it usually mean? Rosh Yeshiva usually means like the head of the yeshiva. He's the one that teaches everybody who's great shiurim. Again, many Rosh Yeshiva today also give Piskei Halacha, but the title of Rosh Yeshiva sounds like learning, like one that's like Gemara. And the Rav, what does the Rav sound like?
He's the Rav, he's the Posek,
right? But yeah, somehow it got switched. Somehow for them, Rav Moshe was the Rosh Yeshiva, he was known as the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Rav was the creator of Gemara Shiurim par excellence, in the Brisker world, at least in the modern Orthodox world. I don't know how that happened, I'm not really sure how that came to be, but that's essentially what it was. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of MTJ. I actually had a chavrusa in YU, who's from the Lower East Side. So he actually, his whole family is affiliated with MTJ, so he always used to tell me things that Rav Moshe used to say, which were not necessarily in his tshuvas, but he would tell me, well, Rav Moshe would say this, and then his two sons who run the yeshiva today, Rav David Feinstein and Rav Reuven Feinstein. Anybody ever heard of them?
Yeah.
They're also very big Talmid Chachamim in their own ranks. Okay, they also quote their father extensively. They both run the yeshiva today. There's two branches today of MTJ. One is in Manhattan, still where it was before, and one is in Staten Island. Okay. But that was Rav Moshe, and that was his main job. However, how is he known today? I mean, how do you know about Rav Moshe? What do you know that he wrote that was like a big thing?
Igros
Moshe, right? Or Igros Moshe, as we say. Okay, that was his work that most people know him by today. If you go on the shelf up in the base medrash, so you'll find, okay, the Igros Moshe is basically, about 8 volumes or so, and it's got tshuvas on like every single subject, which we'll get to in just a second. What's fascinating is, do you know, what did Rav Moshe himself think was his most important work? You probably don't know this, I'll tell you. Take a guess. What kind of work do you think might have been? The type of thing that he wrote. Some other thing that he might have written. On what? Close. Not Tanakh. God forbid. No, I'm just kidding. just kidding. God forbid. He liked Tanakh also. I'm showing you the Tanakh Baal Peh, but Gemara. Okay, he had another sefer on Gemara called Dibros Moshe. They reprinted it today. It looks the same as the Igros Moshe today, but with the same cover and the same blue or whatever the style is, but it's much, much bigger. Every volume is like this fat. Okay, and he didn't write another Masechta. And there, like every piece that he writes on, like let's say a Sugya and Gemara, is like 40 pages long. It's so long and thorough and thought out and really calculated. Amazing. Rav Moshe himself felt that the Digros Moshe was his greatest work in life. That was what he was so proud of. The Igros Moshe? Yeah. Not bad, but okay, yeah, it's nice also. But the Digros Moshe was what was really important to him. And somehow, what seems to have happened, again, fascinatingly how this happens in history, we don't always predict these things, the Igros Moshe became what Rav Moshe was really famous for. And the Igros Moshe is nice also, and people like it, but it's just so long, and it's not as famous. You have a question?
Yeah.
Robert, like, for example, again?
Alpha.
Oh, right.
Okay. It's kind of off topic, but when, like, somebody writes, like, she wrote, like, what gives them, like, the... like not the already? Power, but like the authority to like come up with all these ideas. Like also like commentary on Gemara. Like how do they like know that they're like on that like?
That's a good question. Okay, so this is a general question. Which you're gonna, if you're in Torah Mishnah, you'll focus more on Torah Mishnah. If you're not, you are. Okay, fine. I think everybody is, right? I could just address it very briefly right now, but that's really a Torah Mishnah question. The reason why it's relevant here is obviously because we're going to be learning these tshuvas, and these tshuvas are very important. So I guess the short answer is that he may have thought that he wasn't right for it, but the idea is once you get to a certain level that you know enough Torah, and you have a certain power of analysis, that you feel that you have something to contribute to the halachic or the Talmudic debate, and other people around you also believe that you do, so then maybe you've reached a certain level that you can do that. Now, Again, when it comes to Gemara, it's a little different, because really anybody can write a commentary on the Gemara. Okay, at the end of the year, maybe some of you guys will write some commentary on Gemara. Okay, we'll see. Have a few months still. At least an article for Kol Vaser, right? We hope. There's everybody has something to contribute, okay? Maybe why do you have the right authority to write on Tanakh? Basically, if you feel that you've studied the sources well enough and you have enough of a broad range of material, then you can feel confident in writing something. Now, you may want to show it to some other people first. You may not want to just write it. The Rav Moshe himself also maybe did that. Okay, he wouldn't have passed on these issues, some of them, without getting to a certain point that he felt comfortable and discussing with other people, etc., etc. Rav Moshe, by the way, interesting enough, was self-taught. I mean, he didn't go to yeshiva in Europe. He was taught by, he taught himself. Maybe his father, I think his father taught him. He didn't go to yeshiva in Russia, where he grew up. Okay, he became a Rav in Russia, by the way, afterwards also. Okay, I forgot what it was called. I think a place called Luban or something like that in Russia before he came to the United States. But he got to a certain point where he felt, and others around him felt, that he had a certain, shlita, a certain control over the material in the Torah, that he felt comfortable discussing it. Now, again, he by himself may not have said he should do that, but when people around him say, well, we are appointing you to be the rabbi of the town, and we feel you have that right, and you feel confident enough in your Piskei Halacha that you can analyze a question and take it apart and find the source for it, and come out with it, a cogent analysis enough to give a Pesach Halacha, then maybe that means what we call, that would be okay. Now, in the Halacha, we're not going to go into this now, there is this concept in the Gemara in the Halacha called Higia Lahora, a Talishi Higia Lahora. You have to be at a certain level to be able to paskin. Okay, it's in the Gemara, it's in the Shulchan Aruch in Yeridea. We're not going to go into that now, because it's not really our class, but the question is, you have to get to that point. Your question is, how do you decide that you got to that point? And the question is, maybe, the answer is, maybe it's not just you, maybe other people also have to decide. But certainly Moshe got to that point at some point along the way. Yeah, Alana.
By levels, you mean like spiritual level or level of learning?
I'm at level of learning. Now, spiritual level also is really, really important.
Yeah.
Okay, when it comes to giving a psak, I'll tell you that most posts can have a certain level of Yerush Shemayim, and they daven. Most of them will daven that Hashem should help them, and they write this in their Jewish sometimes, Hashem should help them come up with the right answer. Because even if you know Kol HaTorah Kula, like the Moshe did, and you'll see from the stream, you know everything, but yet still, you're dealing with a modern issue, and the answer to the question is not written straight in the Gemara in the Shulchan Aruch. You have to start picking pieces. What about this one? Why is that different than this one? And what about that one? And what about the people that are going to kill me tomorrow if I don't give them the right answer? And, whatever it is, how do you put that all together? You need a lot of Siyat Nishmai. And that's in addition to everything else. The Yerush Shemayim and the Siyat Nishmai that a Posek has, you're right, is critical when it comes to identifying, a psak. And from their personal perspective on themselves, okay, a very, very, very important thing. So that's a good point. Do you have a question also?
Can not every rabbi paskin then?
So that's the question we said before, of Higia Lahora. Okay, you have to be a Talmud, somebody who is Higia Lahora, that has reached a certain level of learning.
Isn't
and of
that any
confidence.
Rabbi?
What'd you say?
Isn't that any rabbi?
No, not necessarily. I'll tell you the difference. Again, this is a more of a complicated issue, which is really more for Targum Sinai. Just going to say like this. Okay, something which is straight in the Shulchan Aruch, or the Torah, let's say, there's something in the Shulchan Aruch where it says that you can't build a tent on Shabbos, or that building a certain kind of wall is considered to be boner or ohel, or whatever it is. Something like that. Somebody asks you a Shaila, if you can just say, well, the Shulchan Aruch says X, Y, Z, maybe you don't need to be Higia Lahora. The question is, when you discuss an issue like this, and this is going to be a great example, which we'll see today, okay, our question today is going to be on Mechitza, okay, you can't just have any rabbi that can read the Shulchan Aruch talk about Mechitza and give you a Pesach Halacha. You know why? Who knows why?
Because there is
the
factor.
That's one answer. The second one? Mm-hmm. That's right. We are the Shulchan Aruch to the top of Mechitza.
Okay.
The answer is nope. Missing. We'll come back to that in a few minutes, okay? But that's part of the answer. You need to be someone who's a Gil Hara, who knows how to analyze sources, who knows, has a commanding knowledge of Torah Shabbat Peh and Rishonim, etc., to be able to try to figure out, why we need the Chitza. If the Shulchan Aruch didn't say it, we follow the Shulchan Aruch. We're Shulchan Aruch Jews. It doesn't mention it. It's not mentioned. That's it. Let's go conservative. Men and women together. What's wrong? So we'll have to discuss that. Right? But that's a real issue. You understand? Okay. Before we go to the tshuva, just a couple other points here. Just the other tshuva that Rav Moshe wrote, again, he wrote a ton of tshuvas. And the reason why Rav Moshe is so well known and so famous is because he was one of the first poskim that really dealt with a large range of modern issues. Okay, a lot of poskim did, but he was the one that dealt with so many of them. Because the 20th century was really the time that so many new things in technology and society started being introduced to the world. And one of the first people that was, that had halakhic issues that were brought to him about all these questions was Rav Moshe. And he lived at a time when he would obviously get tremendous talmud chacham, so he dealt with a lot of these issues that nobody else had dealt with yet. And essentially, he had to be the first one to come up with some sort of answer. So I'll give you some interesting ideas here, okay, if you just look. Some of these are new, some of them are not. The Chait we'll discuss in a second, but we'll look at the other examples of major chuva written. So artificial insemination. So that, those of you who are in Eben Hezer, so we're going to talk about that in Eben Hezer. Again, that's a new concept that didn't exist before. You never had IVF before. How are you going to figure out whether the halacha says something about IVF? You need somebody like Ramosha, and people ask him. Somebody like him who knows Kol Torah Kula and can analyze it properly to come up with an answer. Chal Bistral is an old issue, obviously, but there are new factors in America which created another context which might make Chal Bistral, you know, more reason to be lenient about. Okay, we all know Ramosha was lenient about Chal Bistral in America and other places. And this in my Kashrut class, actually, we're going to talk about this. But I mean, the short of it is, anybody know why? Why? What's it?
No, because there are laws in America.
Because of the way the milk is made in America.
Right, the concern is that maybe you're going to introduce non-kosher milk. And in America, the supervision of the government bodies basically ensures that no company will introduce non-kosher milk, because if they did, what would happen to them? Shut down, right? And fine, thousands and thousands of dollars. So Rav Moshe was able to take that concept and translate that into the halacha. So if you ask me, I would say, like, well, okay, that's very nice. But so what? The Shulchan Aruch says you can't drink all these chalavakum. So what am I supposed to do about it if the non-Jews say that it's fine? Comes along something like Rav Moshe and manages to find sources in Chazal and Rishonim to support the concept that if you know 100% that something is not there, then maybe you can rely on that to be lenient. And that's true, by the way, even though in the context of Chol Yisrael, Moshe Achron said that you can't rely on that. They said in terms of Chol Yisrael, even if there's no non-kosher animals in the town, anywhere in the whole country, you still can't drink Chol Avakum.
Weren't there people who had majorly
100%, absolutely there are. But yet Rav Moshe has become accepted as a major deep posek. And that doesn't mean that every single chew is accepted, but many, many, many people accept many, many, many of his chews. Okay? And again, Rav Moshe did not claim to be the end all and be all about every position. He felt he was right many of the times. But certainly there were many posts that argue, and that's fine. But the point is Rav Moshe had so many proofs and he had such a calculated way of discussing things and such a commanding knowledge that in order to argue, you have to know everything yourself first. And again, Rav Moshe made a chidushin. We'll see Rav Moshe, we won't see actually so much, but Rav Moshe had a lot of confusion in his chuvas. But yet, they were so calculated and he was so well accepted that many of his chuvas were well accepted as well. Okay? That's Chol Yisrael, so again, very widely accepted chuva. About Eruv, Rav Moshe had a very unique sheet about Eruv, which we're not going to go into now. He argued with all the Rishonim on Eruv, basically. Because of him, that's one of the reasons why today in Flatbush, they still don't have, the Flatbush Eruv is still subject to controversy. Okay, because according to Rav Moshe's opinion, you can't make an Eruv in many places in New York. Okay? Wow. What?
Why not?
We're not going to go into now. We don't have time. But I can tell you later. Probably London also, by the way. It's just a question of how does he calculate the number of people in any given area. As opposed to most Rishonim, we say something else. Again, I can happy to talk about it another time. If you want to bother me tomorrow, I'm going to tomorrow morning or night. I'll be happy to talk to you. Yeah.
I just have a question. I mean, this might also be to Harmony Sinai, in which case you could tell me without to answer.
Rebecca is going to be loving me next week after providing all these questions.
Yeah, I'm in.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, I'm in.
What's that class called? Torah
Makor HaSatorah.
Okay, fine. So either, meaning some of these questions could go to either one.
Right.
You can filter them.
Just quickly, if you
could
answer.
Yeah.
So you see, like, you say the Tshuva of the Erev, how, like, Rav Moshe argues with all the Rishonim.
Right.
So do we paskin like Rav Moshe always? Do we paskin like him sometimes?
That's a great question. And the answer is it's not clear. It depends on a lot of factors. This is what I think Alana said before. Okay. One of the factors is how good is his analysis. Okay. And sometimes he has sharper points than other times.
Right.
Okay. Sometimes he has certain, you know, chaps where he'll have a chiddush where many other posts may not agree with. And sometimes he'll say, wow, this is a really, really solid point. That's element number one. Okay, element number two is the society rather than the reality. Sometimes, you know, the reality is such that the issue is so pressing that you don't have much of a choice, that if there's a leniency to rely on or Moshe felt that it was okay, people are going to say, let's follow
and
Moshe.
And if Moshe is more mafia, okay. Like, with
the other, depends in the other direction. So Rav Moshe, again, it's split, meaning some people accepted Rav Moshe and some people didn't. Part of that is because of his authority, and the third point is his authority. Okay, the fact that he's such a great authority, even if you don't agree, just to say I'm going to disagree with Rav Moshe just like that, not such a simple thing to do, especially in the United States. In Israel, it's a different story. Because in Israel, they respect him as a big posek, but he didn't live here, you know, it wasn't like he was considered to be one of the final authorities, like in America. And you had a shiloh, like a real big shiloh that affected everybody. Rav Moshe was one of the main people that you would go to. And if he told you a certain halacha, he's not going to, you're not going to say, well, you know, chuck that. So that's essentially, again, a very short answer to a very complex question. Okay, there's more issues as well, but those are, you know, that's the beginning stage. Again, I'm happy to talk about it more at some other time, but that's basically where it comes off. What else do you have? Shaking hands, another interesting one. If you can shake hands, you know, males and females together, their emotion was a little more machmir. He was not into it. He doesn't say it's absolutely awesome. He basically says it shouldn't be done. Bat Mitzvah. He has an interesting chuvah about Bat Mitzvah as well, which we're not going to go into now. End of life issue and medical ethics is a major, major topic for Rav Moshe, and he was asked so many questions, and he passed in a lot of different shilas for medical ethics and end of life, brain death. Part of that is Rabbi Teller, who was a son-in-law, who Rabbi Teller, of course, is a doctor and a Rosh Yeshiva. So he had major, major shuvahs that brain death. Still to this day, there are major debates about what Rav Moshe means that is brain death shuvah, whether brain death exists or doesn't exist halachically. I got a major, major shuvah that you discuss with Rabbi Katz's bio class, if you're in that class, which I do not, because that's in this slot, isn't it?
Is there a
so I guess we could have done that shuvah because it's in this slot. Yeah.
Did Rabbi Teller go against his father?
His father-in-law.
Yeah.
Usually. Sometimes.
I'm saying
usually.
In like.
No, he interprets Rav Moshe to reflect what he believes Rav Moshe is saying. I think that's essentially what it is. And other folks would say, no, that's not at all what Rav Moshe meant.
Okay.
But Rav Moshe's chuva is extremely relevant because he was one of the first ones to discuss the issue of brain death. Smoking is another big one, okay, whether smoking is permitted or not permitted. So Rav Moshe wrote a chuva in 1964, about a few months after the Surgeon General's warning came out. Basically saying, well, it's not so nice, but maybe it's not really usher, etc., etc. That's also a major, major discussion
are
today.
Are we discussing all of these things?
No. Right now we're discussing.
These are just
I'm just telling you these are major tshuvas on many modern topics. Most modern topics, Rav Moshe has something to say. Okay, that's what we're pointing out here. Now, for the rest of the second half of the class, we're going to discuss the tshuva about mechitza. We're not going to read the whole thing inside. And this, by the way, is not the whole thing inside. This is only half of it. It's really long. But we'll pick and choose certain parts that are the most relevant parts, and you'll see. So, everybody ready? All right, here we go. What's the problem?
We don't. Does MMY Paskin like him?
But for which issue?
For the Arab, just the.
In America, you mean?
I mean,
well, actually, it's not so relevant because here you have so many Arabs in Israel, like the Yerushalayim.
Oh, sorry, it's Arab. I was thinking mechitza.
Oh no. So mechitza is a big question. Okay, so that we'll have to discuss.
Okay.
So the question is that we're going to talk about here is mechitza. Rav Moshe actually had like at least 10 tshuvas about mechitza. Okay, he had a lot of shilas about mechitza, and a lot of them were responses to this tshuva that I wrote to you here, Chelek Aleph Siman Lamed Tes in Orach Chaim. Okay, why was mechitza such an interesting issue? This is the historical part of it. Why was mechitza so important? Yeah.
Because of the conservative movement, and they were getting the mechitza together.
Exactly. Okay, so starting with the reform movement in Germany, okay, and then moving into the conservative movement in America and the reform movement in America as well. So many, many shuls were getting rid of their mechitzas. Okay, they felt that was the old school Jews. We're the new school Jews. We can, you know, have men and women sit together. No problem. And when everybody came to the United States, so for the whole, most of the 1900s, okay, what was happening to Orthodox Judaism most of the time until about the 1970s or so? It's going way, way, way down. In danger of, you know, they actually thought maybe it was going to be extinct. Some people said there are not going to be any Orthodox Jews left. Okay? So mechitza is one of the first things to go in many mishals around the tree. And there's a whole book actually. If you're in Ray Lerner's Isha Mitzvah class, I think he does discuss this a little bit at one point. A whole book that I have at home called The Sanctity of the Synagogue, written by a guy who's not even a rabbi. He has to put together all sorts of articles about the mechitza because he had one shul in some far-flung community in Michigan, I think, where they had a question about taking out the mechitza because they had communities in many places that don't exist today. And a lot of these places originally were Orthodox, and then they were, you know, very quickly ready to turn conservative and reform. Because the Jews that came to America, a lot of them dropped their Judaism. Okay? It was the New World. Okay, they didn't, that was from Europe, right? There weren't many shuls left that had mechitzas. And even the ones that did, they were under a lot of attack. The rabbis, the Congress would come to the rabbis and say a lot of times, you know, why don't we do this? Okay, get rid of, if you don't get rid of the mechitzas, we'll get rid of you, something like that. Okay, so this is a major, major shilah to have to defend the Orthodox practice. Now, why was this especially a real shiloh? Because of what I told you before. Where is the talk of mechitza in the Shulchan Aruch? It's not there. Look in Hilchos in Orach Chaim, in the Hilchos Beis HaKnesses, okay, so in Chelav Bet. Look it up tonight. The Kufnun Gimel, Kufnun Dalet, around there. You just skim through it for like 2 minutes. You skim through. There's nothing about mechitza. It doesn't exist. So the Reformed conservative not only would say, well, we're going to get rid of the tradition, but they could also say, well, this tradition is not even mentioned in the Halacha in the first place. So what's the problem? Okay? So this was a real, real shiloh. Again, this is why Rav Moshe's tshuva is so important, because were Orthodox Jews and Orthodox Rabbanim ever going to say that mechitza was okay? What do you think? Think any of them were going to say it's okay? Do you think that Orthodox Rabbanim in the United States and other places in the world would have ever said that without mechitza is okay?
No.
Think it's okay without mechitza? No. But the question is, how are they going to defend it? Where are they going to get it from?
What?
And what way is going to the mechitza going to be understood in terms of its rule, in terms of when it's used, and where we know it's from, meaning the source from the mechitza. That's the question. Yeah.
But like, just missed what you said before. Did you say that because there's no source?
That's part of the question, that mechitza does not have a direct source in the Shulchan Aruch. There's no halachas of mechitza when they talk about the laws in the Shul. You understand? Yeah. Definitely, right?
Yeah. But isn't it like in Yirmiyahu somewhere where it talks about how the men and the women are supposed to be separate and like a bacon set?
Okay, so we'll not exactly.
No,
we're
talks about Mashiach and Yos.
Excellent.
Right? They're going to be mourning the, like at the funeral.
Excellent. Okay, great. Oh. So you guys are right. That's it from Zechariah. That's what you're talking about, probably. Excellent.
No,
so you're that's what you're talking about?
No.
I don't know.
You're talking about when they have like a simcha that they're separated by?
Possibly.
I learned this kind of last year. I don't remember it.
Okay. So let's see. We're gonna see where Moshe is. Where did you go to school? Is it Berea?
Yeah.
So
Berea arts campus.
Okay. Great. So let's go through Moshe's tshuva, and you'll see Derech's tshuva. Some of these sources. I'm not gonna.
We didn't
talk
directly from Moshe Feinstein. We were discussing all the.
I understand. Yeah.
All the different opinions and all of the conceptually, why is this even a question? And then the Torah sources and stuff. So
okay. Good. So here we're going to do it basically through Moshe's tshuva. Moshe is going to quote some of those sources, okay? But just understand for a second the greatness of Moshe. And he wasn't the first one, by the way. There were other posts that discussed this as well. The Chasam Sofer has a little bit of a tshuva and a few others. But the idea that they found these sources in the Gemara, when even though there was no mechitza on the Shulchan Aruch, they were able to go back and find some sources which, you know, are relevant and then apply them. Now, the way Moshe applied the source is going to be a little bit different than some of the other opinions. Okay, you have another comment?
Yeah, also, when you're saying mechitza, do you mean being separate, or do you actually mean like having the
That's a
barrier?
Great question. A great question. Rav Moshe is going to answer that for us, at least in his opinion. Okay, let's see what he says. Okay, ready? Here we go. Okay, b'inyan mechitza shetzarech lios b'veis haknesses bein anashim l'anashim. Okay, that's pretty easy to understand. The sheer govah, and how high does it have to be? So Rav Moshe, by the way, is interesting. He dates all his tshuvas. Okay, this is dated kafbet tevet tafshin vav. Anyone know when Tashin Bav was? It's hard to figure out on the spot. But it's interesting, you can date all his tshuvas and figure out when he was.
1906.
What'd you say? No, that was when he was like 10 years old. even he wasn't that great when he was 10 years old to be writing tshuvas about mechitzas.
Okay.
I think it's actually about 1946. Okay, I think. You can work out the math. I think it's about 1946. This is right in the middle of like, you know, old school America, where everybody was, you know, basically getting rid of their Judaism, and the Orthodox shuls with mechitzas are really, you know, a minority.
It's also rational.
Right, also true. Very interesting. Right after the Holocaust. So here he also writes who he's writing to, okay, which is interesting. Not everybody writes that. Moshe will often tell you who the questions are from, and sometimes people actually can identify the questioners are also big rabbanim that some people know about. I don't happen to know who this one was, but he says, Malak for Yudidi Hanichbad Mod Harav Hargon, Wein Harav David Stern, Minahal Yeshiva Torvadas. You heard of Torvadas in Brooklyn? It's a famous yeshiva in Brooklyn, in Flatbush, okay, Torvadas. This is the Menachal. So here is his question. Okay, he asked basically for me to explain the idea of mechitza, which should be between men and women. What's the height according to the halacha? Mishum, and this is a historical point you see, Mishum Shiesh Mekamos Medina Selo. There are some places in this country, the United States, Shishchilu Lifrot Minyan Mechitza, that basically began to breach the barrier, no pun intended, of the mechitza issue, shebein anashim l'nashim, between men and women in the shul, meaning that all shuls before that always had a mechitza of some form, and now suddenly they people are starting to drop it. Shenisha l'nashim mikdash ma'at, because our shuls have remained for us as a mikdash ma'at, a mini base of mikdash. Devshar, etc., etc. We'll skip that line for now. And basically, he wants to know though. He says basically that maybe people don't realize that it's awesome. Maybe they're just doing it, they don't realize. Okay, maybe yes, maybe no. But he wants to know the source. So look at this. Dine etzem hadin. Okay, next paragraph. Even if men are on one side and the women are on the other side, and there's a separation in between of space, is that sufficient? What does it say, Dafna? Asur heimios b'lomachitza. Okay, they're forbidden to be without a mechitza. You have to have an actual physical barrier. And what's the status of that barrier? Is that the rabbanon, like a takana, deraisa? What does it say here? Lanius dati, Dina? Daraisa, he says, this is Daraisa. Wow, that's a big chiddush. So where are you going to get this from? How is he going to defend saying that mechitza has a Torah source? So some of you already know the answer, partially, but that's like a big claim, okay? Yeah, who had a comment?
Question? Is he only referring to davening?
That's a great question as well, and if we manage to get to the end of the tshuva, we will see the answer. Mm-hmm. Okay, hopefully we'll get there, even if we skip a little bit. Avital, right?
Is Rav Moshe Feinstein the one who talks about garden boys mixing even in a like kosher environment?
Maybe. That's what she asked. We'll get back to it at the end. He doesn't say it for everything, but the question is going to be, well, let me rephrase your question. When it comes to large gatherings of people that are not in shul, does there have to be a separation between men and women? Okay,
like
that's basically, yeah, let's say a wedding, or let's say a shir even. Let's say you have a shir, okay, a mixed shir. Do men and women have to sit separately?
With a barrier. Also.
Same question, okay, and same thing for a wedding. Okay, similar issue.
But
yeah.
Weddings aren't physical. Sometimes
they're
wrong.
It depends which wedding and whose wedding is, you know.
I'm saying by the chuppah, they sit separately.
They have the aisle.
Okay.
Not necessarily some weddings
it
do.
Depends
where. You're right, the most weddings that we've been to are with a separation of space, but not a separation with a barrier.
So in
okay.
My show, we actually room together.
Okay, good. So I'll have to see what Rav Moshe says. Meaning, again, it could be that Rav Moshe's position may be accepted in certain respects for this tshuva of mechitza, and in the other aspects of it, maybe not so much. We'll have to see.
Also, like, is this saying, like, I mean, if you belong, I might, like, if you should have asked this, but is this just saying in Davin, or, like, is he, like, when he's answering this question, is he referring to any situation when men and women would be sitting together?
That's the question. Again, the main question is about the davening during shul. Okay, the question is, whatever you say about that, will the same thing apply to another situation as well, which is not davening? Okay, that's what we're asking. But we're not going to see that until the end. And we're not going to, I'll at least summarize the end, even if we don't get to it inside. Okay, here we go. So he says, where do we get this from? Etzem hadin sh'afim ha'nashim he'mitzadacha v'nashim mitzadacha. Again, we said it's usher d'oraisa. V'raya, second line, v'raya mi'sukah, for prohibition of men and women sitting even separately without physical barriers, still the right side, inshul.
Inshul
during that. I mean, that's what he's saying right now.
They have to have a fit basket.
Yes. Okay. Again, not everybody agrees with this. Okay, some poskim will tell you that may be derabanan, even if the original mechitza is daraisa. Some people might say that you should do it, but if you can't do it, maybe it's different. Again, you Chicago people here, I can tell you some interesting stories about Chicago history from 40, 50 years ago, where the Orthodox Rabbanim and Big Rosh Yeshiva in Skokie, in HTC, who passed in at least temporarily that Orthodox Rabbanim could take shuls that didn't have mechitza as long as they were separated, or even mixed seating for a few months. Again, not for now, but I'll tell you the story some other time. Okay. Anyway, so he says here, Ryan Misukah Daf Nun Al Sheikh Shah the Gemara Al Gzuz Rosh Asun Ezra Nashim Motze Yom Tov. So this is the Gemara, which I didn't photograph it for you, but we'll do it from here. The Gemara in Sukkah Daf Nun Al has a whole story about what happens the first night of Sukkot. Okay, this may be what some of you were talking about. Exactly. So that's when they started the Simchas Beis Shalitah. Now here, of course, who wanted to come see all the celebrations and the festivities and the fire dancing and the torches and all the stuff? Who came? Just men or also women?
Women.
Women also. Okay, they also wanted to come look. So what did they have to do? So basically, the Gemara said, which is not, he's not quoting the first part, but essentially it said that the men and women used to come, and I think the women were on the inside, the men were on the outside, and the problem was that they came, Hayvayim with a Kalos Rosh, that's what the Gemara says. They came to lightheadedness, Kalos Rosh. Okay? So what did they do? So basically, originally, then they started making the one takana, which didn't quite work, and afterwards they made a second takana, which was basically that the women were on top, and the men on the bottom. Okay, that's what he says here on the first night, we'll take the reason, I'll tell you in a second. Okay, Hoshim Hanashim Yilmal Vanashim Yilmata. Okay, the idea is apparently they built a temporary structure. Okay, sort of like bleachers, so to speak. Okay, they have bleachers in that section where the women would sit on the top of the bleachers and the men would be down below, and that would prevent men and women from mingling. Exactly. Now he's going to prove from here that it's an Isser D'oraisa now to have. Even separate seating without a mechitza is still into the rest. So let's see how he proves it. So the Gemara asks then, "Haktiv hakol bichtav." The Gemara says, "Wait a second. It says in Divrei Hayamim that everything was written down. What does that mean? It means that in the Beis Hamikdash, okay, when Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis Hamikdash, he built it based on instructions from his father David. Okay, and it says there that everything that was done in the temple was according to the rules of God, what Hashem told him to do." So now comes along the Chachamim reporting what happened in the Beis Hamikdash later, that they would build these bleachers as a temporary structure just for, Simchas Beis HaShoeva. So wait a second, how can you do that? That's not part of what it says in Tanakh. It doesn't say that anywhere. How can you do that? You see the question? No?
But doesn't it, what is discussed though, basically?
You're lost? Okay, let's back up. Okay, what'd you say? Not exactly. No.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Even in Tanakh, you already find that when Chana came to Davin for,
she wasn't.
She was right next to Eli.
But doesn't it talk about Ezra and Nashim? Moshe somewhere?
Yeah, exactly an Ezra Moshe. But at the time of the synthesis of the Shoeva was close enough together that basically it was what's it called? It was enough mingling of Kalos Rosh that they needed to separate.
The concept of Chana Shila dominating is not the same as the basic.
You might be right. Correct. Again, what the Gemara is quoting here is a pasuk from Divrei Hayyam, which basically says Hakol Bichtav Hashem or something like that. And when they built the temple, everything was done based on God's instructions. So the Gemara is understanding that to mean that you can't add on something to the Beis HaMikdash without God's explicit agreements. Understand? So they're then saying that if they made a temporary structure of bleachers for women on the night of Sukkot every year, how is that permitted when it doesn't say in the Tanakh that they're allowed to do that? Understand?
And they did the bleach thing during.
They built it in the Beis HaMikdash like every year for Sukkot.
In the Beis HaMikdash.
Yeah, they built the bleachers like next to the Ezra's Nashim or whatever. Okay? And they took it down after they finished with it. So how can they do that? Understand? Not allowed, according to the Gemara. Also, the host of Shum Davar Vidyan Habayis, you're not allowed to add anything to the building of the temple, Ubazara, and in the courtyard. So what's the answer? But Tirat's Rav and Rav and the Gemara answers to Kra Ashkechu. They found the pasuk. Shetzarach lahavla anashim inashim kibiteirish Rashi. Okay? They found the pasuk that shows that men and women have to be separate. Now, what's that pasuk? Some of you mentioned it before. Okay, in Zechariah. Okay, the Navi Zechariah. There's a pasuk which basically says that when they're mourning something, it's not clear what, some people say they're mourning Mashiach ben Yosef. Okay, not clear to Mashiach here, but there's a tradition in the Gemara that there's going to be two Mashiachs, Mashiach ben David and Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben Yosef is going to die like in war or something like that. Okay, a whole discussion today whether he lived already or didn't live. Some people say maybe that was like one of the army generals in Israel 30 years ago, who knows what. Yeah, it's very interesting. Okay, whatever it is. But there it says that all the families, the Mishpachot, are going to eulogize, whoever it is, family by family. Okay, anashim v'nashim, men and women. And basically, what the Gemara derives from there is that in this time of the eulogy, the men and women are going to be separate. Okay, what does the Gemara say? Basically, again, I apologize, I didn't put the Gemara here. Basically, it's a pasuk in Zechariah, which basically says, I don't have it in front of me, that the families and the men and the women are going to eulogize the person. It's not clear who he is. The Gemara, according to one interpretation, says it's talking about eulogizing Mashiach ben Yosef in future times. Okay, but it says clearly that the men and the women are going to eulogize him. It sounds like the men and the women separately are going to be eulogizing, but they're not necessarily going to be standing together. That's what it sounds like. That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, if in a case where we're talking about a eulogy, what was the last time that people got to lightheadedness during a eulogy at a funeral? Okay, when you go to a cemetery, are you lightheaded? Are you going to start laughing and like joking together and doing other things, winking at each other and flirting and stuff like that?
No.
Should hope not, right? I really hope not. If you are, something's wrong. Okay. If that's true in the case of a funeral, then Kava Chomer, certainly, when it comes to Simchas Pesach Shoeva, which is a very happy event, everybody's celebrating, everybody's into it, of course, in that case, you have to have a separation. Make sense? The Gemara says, because of that pasuk, that shows you that it's permitted to build a separate structure in the temple to separate the men and the women. Did everybody understand that? Did everybody not understand that? Does that make sense? That's what the Gemara says. Yes.
Is there not a halakha? I don't know if I'm right, but my brother told me that there's a halakha from the Torah that a man can't watch a woman dance.
A man can't
watch a woman dance.
Do you believe everything your brother says?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't there be like a separation for that purpose anyway?
That's unclear. Okay, it's not clear whether it's actually forbidden to watch a woman dance. Okay, halacha l'maisa, you shouldn't do it. I mean, a man shouldn't do it. But in the sources, it's not so clear.
But can he listen to a woman sing?
That's a different issue. That's a halacha of kolisha.
But didn't the entire Sheva of Binyamin watch 200 women dance with their wives?
So that's a question. Okay, that's why it's not so clear. Okay, if you look at even the Mishnah says that they used to go out to the fields, and all the women used to dance on tuba of, to show, oh, come pick me, come choose me to get married,
also,
watching them. Apparently, everybody's watching them. What? That's a question. Yeah, so it's hard to say exactly. Halakhul Maisa. What? This is also just, this is not relevant, but I mean, it is relevant, but I just happened to see on the internet somebody put up a video, like an archive video from the Kotel from like the 1920s or 30s. And guess what?
They're
not dancing, but men and women are basically davening like right next to each other, and they're all going back and forth right in between each other.
No, nothing.
Can you believe that? Very interesting. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have mechita the shul. I'm just saying that. God forbid I didn't mean that. So the person who wrote that was just upset about the women of the wall. They were like writing because they were like upset because they were like reformed and they supported the women of the wall that go to, you know, down to the palace and fill in, you know, the whole story.
They were using that as a proof of why.
So they were basically saying that this shows that it's not right for the male, you know, the men who like throw stones at them to like get so upset.
But
they're right.
The men in the 20s were okay with it, and the men now should be okay with it too.
Something like that. It's not exactly the same issue, but I guess that was their point. Yeah. Hey, it's interesting. The halakhic answer, by the way, to that, again, it's a fascinating point, which we don't have time for now. Another, you know, piece of history. You can Google it. It's online. From, I forgot where. I can find you a link if you want. It was really, you know, very interesting. But at that time, the kozel wasn't a shul. They didn't daven there. So that's why. Only in the 1960s, when they actually got the kozel back, they actually made it into a shul. Once it became a halakhic status of the shul, then they made it into a pizza. You understand? That's the terrace halakhically to the answer. But
does it have all
that? Then that means that we need the
pizza. Yeah. What?
He's not saying it's a legitimate thing for them.
I'm saying you just answered the question.
Yeah.
But, okay.
That's the answer. Their point was you shouldn't go crazy at these kind of things because in the 1920s, you know, nobody had problems with the fact that men and women were just diving right next to each other. Okay. Anyway. Okay. So Rav Moshe basically says here that that's the Gemara. I mean, that Gemara is going to be the source that we need a mechitzah. Okay, this is fascinating. That Gemara is not talking about a halacha today. It's not talking about a shul. It's talking about the Beis HaMikdash. But yet, we say that if in the Beis HaMikdash, in this type of event where there were men and women mixed together, they were coming to Kalas Rosh, they needed a mechitzah, they needed to have a balcony. Certainly, when it comes to shuls today, that should be a requirement. So you understand where he's going with this?
Yeah.
Now, we didn't finish it, but go on. Yeah,
when
question?
He said that, before the women were in the middle and the mechitza was like with them on the outside, is that what you said?
Well, it's not clear there was a mechitza at all. There was
a
separation.
There was a
separation of space, but it wasn't necessarily a barrier.
Yeah, but what was the
layout? Apparently, they needed a barrier. What?
What was the layout of it? Like, what was it like, woman, man, or woman?
Basically, the Rashi talks about it there in the Gemara there. The women were in the Ezra's Nashim, which is like over here, let's say. And the men were like in the Azara, in the Chel around it, which is like sort of over here. Okay, something like that.
Okay,
okay, this is like the innermost part, and this is like inside there. This is the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kodesh over there, or whatever it is. Okay.
Wait, when you said the Gemara said that they should be separate, what were they doing there?
This was the similar space of Shoyim, the celebration of Sukkot.
No.
Oh, in the Pasuk, in Zechariah?
Yeah.
Because the Pasuk was a eulogy, okay, for Mashiach ben Yosef, maybe, for somebody else. That's one interpretation that was from Mashiach ben Yosef, but it's a eulogy. Either way, it's a eulogy. So the point is, even for a eulogy, if they felt that they needed a separation, when people are not happy, certainly when it comes to celebrations like a Simchas Beis HaShoeva, you should need...
But it could be that they're finding comfort in each other.
They
want to find comfort in each other, and like hug each other because they're sad.
So there's some point, okay, I think the Gemara is saying that's a concern. Again, by the way, you could understand, I'm not sure if it's talking about even hugging and kissing, it could even be like just interaction, mingling, okay, which is a question. Yeah, that point I guess has to be just a little longer. We don't have so much time, so we're gonna have to cut that for now. But it's an interesting idea. Okay. Now, what is Rav Moshe gonna have to prove in this Gemara? What he's gonna have to prove in this Gemara, we see that there's a source from Mechitza with a barrier. But he's gonna prove in this Gemara that it's the Raisa also. Okay? He says, look at this next line. Pasha Chakabana Sa Teratu Shalachenu Kimafurash Shatsaref Lasos Hazizun Magzutra. Basically what the Gemara is trying to say is that the Pasuk that the Gemara gave about this thing in Zechariah as a proof that you need to have a mechitza basically means it's as if it's explicit that they were supposed to build a structure, a balcony, for the stand. That's how he's understanding the Gemara. The law hooked struck by Amr Zeh, like they got a chod of an asam nadi. It wasn't needed to be stated when it talks about Shodilan al Piashem Lachas Atavis. Have a Gamzeh, we made a Bechal al Kobichtav. And basically, what he's saying is that automatically, that this concept of building the balcony for the Chesbeis HaShoeva was implicitly included in the rule of Akol Bechtar, that they had to, you know, follow the rules of God in building the temple. Meaning it's ki'ilu, as if God gave them implicit permission for building a balcony for Sukkot, because we know from another pasuk in Zechariah that you have to have a separation between men and women. You understand what they're saying? This is saying, even though it doesn't say that, and it says it has to be from God, it's as if God already told us that we need to have a separation, because the Tanakh says that when you have a eulogy, you have to have a barrier, you have to have a separation. So certainly here also, it's as if God gave us permission, and that's how we know that they were allowed to build the separation. Does that sort of make sense? What does that mean according to Rav Moshe? So if you skip here a second, well, he says, so the next line, Im hayah zeh rak isur d'rabbanan, if this is only an isur d'rabbanan, well, yashayach l'meimar shu mimeilu b'chlal kol b'chtav, keiv she'in tzarev zeh midaraisa. Okay? We're not going to go to the rest of it here. Basically, he says that if it was only a din d'rabbanan for mechitza, then you can't possibly say that a din drabanan is included in a pasuk that Hashem agreed to. Hashem is not, there's no drabanan yet. Rabbinic laws came much later. So if we're saying that this is included in the rules of building the temple, and you're allowed to build this also, then that can't be rabbinic. It must be d'oraisa. Okay? Therefore, Moshe says that the halacha of mechita with the barrier is d'oraisa. Okay? That's basically what he tries to get out of here. Okay, let's skip a little bit. We have to finish up.
He said that there would be a problem with the Beit HaMikdash or the Pasuk in Zechariah.
They're basically allowed to build a balcony in the Beit HaMikdash because of the Pasuk in Zechariah, which shows you that God always would have said that it's okay that you should build it.
And that's from the Torah, not from the Torah.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that because of the Torah prohibition that they could be together, they have to be separated according to the Torah. Therefore, we can assume that when they told Shlomo to build the temple in a certain way, it was obviously understood that in this event where they're mingling, you know, for the Shoeva, that they're allowed and they're required even to build a balcony to make a mechitza. Okay, that's essentially what he's doing here. He's going to say now, of course, that the mechitza is d'oraisa. Okay? Now the question is, how tall does the mechitza have to be? Okay? So the question is, what's the point, right? What are we trying to prevent here? So Moshe wants to argue the following. He wants to argue that the point is to prevent kalas rosh. Look at the last paragraph on the first page. Okay, hayotzi mizeh. See that? You see this here? Mm-hmm. Hayotzi mizeh. We see from this, hayotzi mizeh, gam batei knesios shemiskatzin shem anashim v'nashim, it's kalal, okay, when you go to a shul, to daven, tov yoser lasos kizitzrash anashim yilamal. Listen to this. He says, just like in the Beis HaMikdash, what did they build? A second level. So too for a mechitza, where should the women be? On a balcony on the second floor. Well, very interesting, right? And then he says, if for whatever reason it's hard to make a kizitzra, shrichin lasos mechitza mamish kazu shetim ramidon lo de kalas rosh. You have to make a mechitza like the one they made, which prevents coming to kalas rosh, to lightheadedness. The low sagi mashinach shem mechitza lechol davar, go sharm suchim, etc., etc. He says you can't just make any mechitza. How big is a regular halacha mechitza? Let me know. Just by halachically, but in even in halacha terminology, how many tefachim is a mechitza usually?
3, 5,
10. 10 tefachim, right? A halachic mechitza is usually 10 tefachim. If in most areas of halacha you need a mechitza, can I ask you a question? How tall is a wall in your sukkah have to be? How high? Minimum. 10 tefachim. Okay. The minimum height, again, usually it's higher, but the minimum height is 10 tefachim. Okay, that's a halachic mechitza, is 10 tefachim.
How much is 10 tefachim?
10 tefachim is roughly, let's say, between 80 to 100 centimeters. How many inches is that? I can't remember.
I don't know, I only know feet.
You only know feet?
That's meat.
12
inches.
I'm
really
bad at that.
I can never remember. I keep getting mixed up between feet and
meters.
Not so
high.
Can you do meters?
It's like 4 feet.
So again, it's about 10 tefachim is about 80 to 100 centimeters.
It's about like that.
I'll tell you, 10 tefachim, again, it's machlok shita. I'll tell you, okay? Rav Chaim Noah, the regular shita of 10 tefachim is about like this high. Okay, can you believe this? This is about 10 tefachim right here. The Chazon Ish would say maybe it's about over here. He's a little bit taller.
Well, this is like,
pretty crazy, right?
So that's a
cushion. So now, tell me, according to Rav Moshe, is this mechitza going to be sufficient?
No,
why not?
That when you're talking about measurements and height requirements for what you have to put in Erevan, isn't that where the 10 tefachim come in?
Yeah, that's another halacha. I mean, there's a lot of halachas that 10 tefachim is.
So he uses the word mechitza there also.
Yeah, 100%. 100%, exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah.
My father's Shul Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, they put a, like in the courtyard, they put a thing separating the men and the women's entrance and like separating them, like. Rosh Hashanah, so people come out and if they want to see their family because we have a break, they go across the room.
That's funny.
You know, we have separation.
Wow. Which one's that again?
In Israel, America. It's mostly just because, like for convenience, but, like, yeah, right. Like it. It's nice.
Okay, good. So, again, that's not the actual sanctuary, which is why, you know, there's more room to talk about that. Yeah, quick point.
Who says that it needs to be 10 tefachim? Where is that?
Do you know what I think?
I mean, didn't you just say that?
I didn't say that. I'm
You said, what's the halachic minimum? And then we said, tzvachim, and then you were like, yeah.
Okay, so normally speaking, the normal halacha of what is considered to be a halachic mechitza is 10 tzvachim. Okay,
by
who? That's in the Gemara. Okay, the issues of sukkah and eruv and kalayim and all these different things, it's assumed a 10 tzvachim makes a halachic wall. What Rav Moshe is arguing here is that in this context of mechitza for shul and for mingling, that can't be good enough. You know why? Because if there's a mechitza here, and I come talk to you, guy, you're standing up, okay? I can see you quite well, I can talk to you quite well. I can mingle great, right? I'll try not to during shul, but you understand the point? Okay, it's quite easy to go to the mechitza. Hey, you know what? Guess what? You know, come over here, come talk to me. It won't work, right? So how are you possibly going to prevent kalos rosh? So what's the answer? The mechitza must be higher than that. How high does it have to be? So let's keep reading here, Moshe. Okay, we're in the middle of that last paragraph there. Basically says again, v'lachim osagi, it's not good enough to make a mechitza ten tzvachim from around sheda klum l'inyan kalos rosh. Men can go and talk to it as they please if the mechitza is that short. Li shum koshi, li gabi dayan. Okay, without difficulty, and also they can touch them. Okay, the eilcha kalas rosh gadol mizu. No kalas rosh greater than that. The nachshavim kimulor and mash. It's as if they are completely mixed together. The asur midorais according to him. Shagruhim mechitza shivdil benezos nashim lechil v'mikdash, etc., etc. Basically, that's even worse than the mechitza in the base of mikdash. Okay. Etc., etc. Let's skip a little bit here. Here we go. Skip down two lines after the period. Okay, right over here. Aval, see this? Aval mistamber la nias dati, that's lamed ayin dalek, shesangi b'mechitza gevoa adacharak sefayim. From Ramosh says he thinks that the sufficient height is to wear
shoulder
height. Tarei chaziman.
Wait,
who
thinks that?
What did you
say? He does.
Ramosh is saying this now. Tarei chaziman shamechitza ena mitzad isri istaklus. He says, I know that the mechitza has nothing to do with the stakos, okay? Men are not allowed to gaze at women, you know, with the tendency to get benefit from it, pleasure, for enjoyment. But that doesn't mean that, Ramosh says, that's not clear. You have to make a wall that you can't see them. That's something the men themselves have to be careful about. But what do the men and women both together have to be careful about in terms of the halakha of mechitza? That is the question of Kalos Rosh, okay?
I don't
care.
So
he says,
that's
yeah. So essentially what he's trying to say here is basically he's saying that a shoulder length, shoulder height barrier, mechitza, will be sufficient to separate men and women from being
together. A normal person.
Yeah. A normal person, correct.
An average.
You might have somebody who's really, really tall and maybe another person who's really, really tall on the other side. But mostly, like, you take normal rules.
Then you can see their faces.
But it's not easy. If you have a mechitza, let's say here, that's like up till here, it's not so easy to talk to the person on the other side. It's doable, it's doable. But it's much easier to prevent cholesterol.
So the problem is that it has to be shoulder.
Correct. Okay, that's essentially Rav Moshe's halacha, that it has to be shoulder length mechitza.
In order to prevent kalos.
Correct. Now he writes later on, it's turn the page to the other side.
How much time do we have? We have 5 minutes.
Okay. The second top paragraph over here on this side. Okay. So skip here, basically, it's the second to last line of that paragraph, of who gova gimel amos? Shehen yud ches tfachim. Okay, he says the measurement of that is 3 amos, which is 18 tefachim high, and he has sources to prove it, which I don't have on the sheet, but you look at the Gemara Shabbos and Dabzadi Beis, and Rashi and Tosfos and Tosfos elsewhere, Rav Moshe had to find the sources, okay, he knew what he was talking about. So in all those Gemaras, it's clear that shoulder height is 18 tefachim. How high is 18 tefachim? It's roughly in inches, roughly 65 inches, maybe 66 inches, or something like that. Okay, maybe if you hold up, what's it?
5.5 feet.
Roughly something like that, yeah. Okay, That's according to the chazan. Maybe that's the more machmir approach. Maybe if you have a more lenient approach, that's 60 inches. And of course, the more machmir approach is about 65 inches. There are different opinions about how long it's talking about. Is that the problem?
Yeah, maybe in the summer that you do, you have 60 and 66.
That's right. Okay, 60 that's and 66. Right. Meaning basically, because there's a machlokas about how big a tepach is, that creates a difference of opinion of how tall 18 tefachim is. Okay, either 60 or 66 inches. Okay, that's in inches and centimeters, I don't remember how long and how high it is. Approximately average shoulder length, which is approximately about here, roughly. Okay? That's what he says. Are we good with that so far?
Yeah.
Okay, before we get to the second point, which we're not going to have time to do in detail, but we'll discuss it briefly, but before we get to that, so now, can you conceive of someone who might have said that maybe a mechitza for shul is also sufficient to be 10 tefachim high?
Yeah.
You're talking very good. You said you're going to speak to the right answer. Okay, excellent. So you mentioned that?
Yeah, he mentioned that...
he says that there that the point of a mechitza isn't for kalas roads, but it's to prevent mingling.
Okay.
I think.
Or Moshe is arguing that even mingling can take place if you have.
No, so I think
he means physical mingling, not like talking mingling, right?
I'm trying to remember because we were talking about like if you're coming from the position that it's called approach, then that's where Moshe's opinion is coming from. But the salvation comes from a different perspective of why is there a necessity for mitzvah?
Right.
I think that it was like actual mingling.
Right. So Moshe, I think, is more along the lines of separation, but it just has to be a physical separation between men and women. It's not only about mingling, it's not mainly about that physical separation. And in order to have a physical separation, a halacha mechitza is sufficient. Therefore, the Rav said that a mechitza, which is 10 tefachim, which is about 39 inches or so, roughly, exactly what we said before, Rosalajan, the Rav, not the Rosh Shiva, the Rav. Right?
39 inches?
I don't remember the exact measurement, but again, it's 10 tefachim, which we said is about 80 centimeters, according to the lower measurement, according to the Chaim Noah and the Chazanish, those are the two measurements for measuring tefachim. I think it was rough. So here's the thing. The Rav, I think, only gave the heads to out-of-town communities where it was very difficult to have a higher mechitza. I mean, in principle, he did feel the mechitza should be higher than that. But he said that if you're stuck and otherwise you won't be allowed to put up any mechitza, this is what they're willing to give you, etc., etc. So then, you know, the Rav felt that was the minimum amount that you could have.
Ten
tefachim. And that's why I think they call the Rav's out-of-town heads. That's what I used to say. Out-of-town heads. Out-of-town being New York, of course. Maybe in some, no offense to the out-of-towners. But even in New York, some places might be included.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have one of those.
That's, I would agree with that. So that would basically be, especially look at the Oshel and Merrick.
Yeah, they have.
I think their mechitza is probably about 10 tefachim, right? Yeah. Even a little less. Whatever it is.
But they're like, the Rav says it's okay. We're like, all right, guys.
Good. But again, that's what's known is that the Rav only said that in cases when it was absolutely necessary. Okay, it wasn't like a lechachila for the Rav.
No,
he felt that it was sufficient, but it wasn't ideal.
No, the other side of the mic.
Okay. By the way, Rav Henkin, I think, also agree with that. Okay, Rav Henkin was another one of the big Rav on him on the Lower East Side before Moshe, a little bit earlier than him. They overlapped. He was also one of the big Gedolei HaDor. He also apparently felt that 10 tefachim was sufficient. Okay, any questions on that part? All right, last before we finish up. Okay. Now, could there be, actually there's really 2 points, could there be anybody that might argue with Rav Moshe on this question about what the point of mechitza is? The answer is, meaning not just to be more lenient, but even to be more stringent. The answer is?
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay. There are many, many poskim who said that the point of mechitza was not to prevent mingling, or kalas rosh, but rather so that the men shouldn't look at the women. Now, where did they get that from? The Gemara talks about kalas rosh. Where did they get that from? You know what?
Torah.
What did
you say? Torah. I mean, how do you get to kalas rosh?
Yeah. The Gemara mentions kalas rosh.
No, I'm saying, like, how does a person...
Torah has stakos. Okay, good. So that's one option. So it's actually a better thing also. The Moshe quotes here. Look at this paragraph again. Okay?
Which one?
Okay. The top paragraph on the second page here, okay? Top part, right after the BR, which doesn't belong there, but that was how it got copied in Barilan for whatever reason. The Rambam himself in the Parish of Mishnah says the reason for the Mechitza was for a stakos, so the men shouldn't look at the women. Comes along, Satmar Rebbe and many other poskim and say, look at this! This means that the Mechitza has to be such that they can't see each other. Shoulder length is not sufficient. Instead, it's got to be all the way up there. Right? And that's what many poskim posit, that's what many shuls do. What does Moshe say? Say, you know what? Moshe, he's good. Look at this. The next line. So he gives a whole first item quote for you. He gives a whole explanation of why he feels that the Rambam himself had to mean what he thought it meant, which is basically that his stakos doesn't mean his stakos, it means his stakos, which will lead to kalas rosh. And he gives all sorts of proofs for it. He goes into a whole lengthy thing about like the structure and the base of Mikdash and the chel and the azara. It's crazy. All this kachim stuff. Yeah.
This is what he thinks the Rambam would
do. That's what he interprets the Rambam to mean. And then he says, but I don't think this topic, the chavaras of perishal, even if we're not sure what he meant, ladina lahalacha elam el mashkas haramam halachasav. There's a Mishnah Torah. The Rambam has a book called the Mishnah Torah, and that's his halacha book. Not perishal Mishnah, which is explanation on the Mishnah book. But the Mishnah Torah, he says, perakein lehalachas, that should be based on the chivar there. Halacha test. Shuv kadeshul yuhu rabbin. He quotes the halacha, and he says, the reason why is they shouldn't be mixed together. And then he says, perakhas lehalachas lulav. Shekartha kadeshul yis arv elim elu. So even if in the Parashah Mishnah he says one thing, we pass the like the Mishnah Torah, and there he says, my reason. They shouldn't mix together, they shouldn't be mingling, they shouldn't come to Kalas Rosh. So Moshe says, Lahalacha, that is the bottom line, it's based on Kalas Rosh. Okay, so Halacha L'maisa, till this day, we have a major machlokas between poskim about where the Mechitza can go. So some poskim are very machmir and say it's got to be that you can't see the other side. And there goes Admiral Magel, in honor of Moshe, I basically say, no, as long as it's sufficient to prevent Kalas Rosh, shoulder length, roughly, that would be sufficient. Yeah.
When you say halacha to Maisa, what does Maisa mean?
Like, bottom line today, halacha to shul. You go to a shul today, what do you follow? What does the shul follow?
Okay.
Practical halacha.
Mishnah Berurah says.
Mishnah Berurah doesn't talk about this.
Mishnah Berurah.
Okay. Last one, just finish this up, okay? The very last paragraph, which we don't have time to read inside now, where Moshe focuses on the question of whether this mechitza halacha applies only to shul or anywhere else. And you know what he says? He says, we're sort of like a little bit forced to say that this halacha is midoraisa. You know when? B'chol makom kibbutz, in any situation where there is a large gathering of men and women. You know why? Because what was the pasuk of Zechariah about?
Funeral.
Yeah, it's a funeral. That's not in shul. That's everywhere. Okay? And he says, that's even about tzniyos ba'alma. Apparently, Moshe feels he's very machmir, that even in another big event, big gathering with a lot of men and women, you need to have a mechitza. The other post, by the way, the ones that hold that you have to be histakos, that might be different. They may actually hold that's only halacha in the shul. So in that area, they might be more makil.
Why?
Because they may say that the whole takana in the base of Mikdash of not looking at each other was only in a case where it was in the base of Mikdash, only in actual status of a shul. It's not clear. I mean, you're right, you could say histakos point for them also, even if it's a different event. But I don't remember who says it. Some post, I forgot which one, some actually say explicitly that the halacha of histakos doesn't apply necessarily outside of the shul. Okay, it's like a takana that you can't, you have to have a barrier that you can't see. So halacha l'maaseh, this is already much more split. And even people that follow Moshe, that the height of the mechitza may not necessarily also follow his extension to other areas of halacha as well, which are not inside the shul itself. Okay, again, very, very interesting. Last point I was just going to mention is that there's a lot of other details here that are relevant according to Moshe's opinion. Well, we're not going to read it inside. If you look at the English here, this is something for a new stat, which he basically talks about Moshe's sheath, and he gives you a whole bunch of other things also. It has to be high enough to completely block the entire women's section. What about glass? Okay. So he has the two sides here, okay? The first side here, again, we're not reading it inside. The first side here over here is the first side of the histakos side. It's got to be above your head. And the second side is Moshe's side. So according to Moshe's side, the second one, you see the height there? He mentioned the 60 to 60 inches. He says that, I think he says that glass would be okay. All right, glass is fine because it prevents the mingling. Okay. The problem is that when we're not dressed properly, then already the glass might be a shot.
I don't think we have it.
Is that not the sheet? The second sheet here?
No.
There's two pages.
We got one. Like, it was a double sided.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, so I'll put it on the screen next time. Okay.
No, I mean, they're there and you have
them. We have it.
Okay,
is
this it?
Yeah, there were two sheets.
Yeah, this is the second sheet.
I got one.
Okay, anyways, last question. Yeah, that's it. Last question.
Your question is, wait, but Rav Nussbaum says that it can't be made from glass.
So the Rav Nussbaum quotes two sides. The first side that he quotes is the Machmir quotes, and the whole that is sort of stopless, and it's got to be over your head. Okay. According to that side, glass is no good because you can see. You understand?
Okay,
for most parts, which is the second side, hold that glass is sufficient.
Mechitza?
That's a good question.
He says that he needs to reach the shoulder like the women's.
Right. So technically, he says it's not necessary.
Understanding.
He says, over here, this is from a different shoot of Moshe. These, by the way, are all from different shoots of Moshe on Mechitza that he quoted this from. A balcony does not need to be encircled with a partition or a curtain. It is preferable and recommended, however, to do so if possible. That's another shoot in one of the other places in Moshe. Okay.
So even if, well, then there really isn't like a physical barrier.
There is, because they're up in the balcony.
Fine, so
you have to go up the stairs in the back to get there.
What about a shul that has a bleacher?
It's literally connected. No, it says the mechitza must reach the required height. Wait. Look at the back.
So Lincoln Square is an interesting case because basically you can like be right next to the wooden, like right there.
No, it says
Lincoln. There's another
It says the mechitza must reach. If you look at the last point in the English, it says the mechitza must reach the required height in both the men's and women's section, raising the floor of the women's section, which in effect lowers the height of the mechitza, defeats the purpose.
So that's without a balcony. Okay.
If the floor is just a little bit higher, so you can be standing right next to each other, but she's higher, it has to reach shoulder length on her side also.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think it's when they're standing also. Each row of women's seats is higher up than
the men. Yeah. So it's interesting. And also the men face the women, I think, right? I think look at Twitter, when some of the men
face
the women.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's in the
right, exactly. It's around, yeah. Very quickly, you had a last question, Alana?
Yeah.
What about the one you can see, like with the mechitzas where the woman can see the men's side and the men can't see the woman's
side?
That's
a great question. What do you think?
Well, because if the prohibition is only that the men can't see the woman's side, if it's because of sneeu, but then why is it that?
No, but it's closed men.
There's no problem with women seeing the men's side. That should be fine. The question is in terms of the height. So if the height is sufficient,
well, if the height is sufficient,
then it should be fine.